I think this evening, as I mentioned, I was going to talk a little bit about how we can cope with fear and anxiety. As someone in Sri Lanka, where I spend quite a bit of time, has asked me to talk about that. So this is an opportunity to do that. And it seems very appropriate to talk about this, because it's become something that is part of all our lives since the arrival of the coronavirus. And so I'd like to look very, very much more at how we can deal with fear and anxiety, because the Buddha's teaching is very practical and it's very, very useful for us to deal with our emotional states, with developing wisdom, with developing kindness, all these states of mind. And as I mentioned before, so that we can be a mind that is at home with itself. And the way I'd like to look at this is looking at the twin hallmarks of the Buddha's teaching, which I think most people would recognize as wisdom and compassion. So this is the structure that I look at, at how we can deal with, how we can cope with fear and anxiety. Because wisdom, of course, this is something that the Buddha emphasized, and is the path to liberation. And compassion is the natural outcome of that wisdom that understands the world, that understands the situation that all beings are in, and therefore has that wish to help, that wish to give support in whatever way possible. And so the important thing with the wisdom is that once we understand a situation deeply, it really changes how we relate to the situation very much. And it reduces our suffering, the difficulties we find. And I think everybody can has this experience in their lives. Sometimes they've had people say or do things and they've really been upset by it. But later they found out some other information, you know, that the person was had a very bad experience at work or some difficult situation in their life that made them say and do those things. And when we understand, when we get more information, when we have a fuller picture, when we have the perspective, the larger perspective, the bigger picture, we can understand what where they were coming from and let go of a lot of these negative reactions that we may have. And of course there's that story I quite like that Ajahn Brahm often tells of the man who went to the market, whose wife asked him to go to the market to buy some eggs, and he goes to the market and then there's a young man he meets at the market, and that young man abuses him and with many strong words, and he gets very upset and he doesn't buy the eggs, and then he goes home and he tells his wife that, and she asks him, where are the eggs? And he said, well, I was going to buy them, but I was abused by this young man. He called me all these names. He was really letting loose with all this language. And she said, oh, what did he look like? And he described the man. He said, oh, him. Oh, he when he was young, he had head damage, head injury. And ever since that, he's been like this. When the man understood that, oh, no problem. He went back to the market. I don't know if he got abused by the young man again, but he could buy the eggs because he understood. It's the same for all of us. When we understand a situation, that's the arising of wisdom. That's when the penny drops. And because of that, you can see the other side of that story too, is that that man could have compassion for that young man, that he had suffered this injury. that, you know, was going to affect the whole of his life and would make him this very abusive character. So this is where the arising of where wisdom feeds into compassion and allows us to feel that sort of empathy for people, feel with them in their situations. And of course, with compassion, we have the wish to do what we can to support that person, whether it is emotionally, whether it is with physical support. I always remember, though, Ayin Khema, she said that we shouldn't be confused about compassion. She said, if one is helping another person out of compassion, but one ends up suffering just as much as the other person, she said, what's the use? There are two people suffering now instead of one. So compassion has to have that wisdom that understands that we do what we can give the support that we can give, and not suffer at the same time. Of course, we're able to empathise with the person, but if we empathise too much, if we are overcome with suffering ourselves, we can be of little help to the other person or ourselves. So this is very important, I think, with compassion. And as I say, compassion always has that aspect of wisdom with it. I often think of compassion and a lot of the Buddha's teaching as emotional intelligence. It's the emotions engaged with wisdom, and this is a very important aspect. You always see, for instance, faith balanced with, or faith or confidence based with, balanced with wisdom. So I'll start with talk a little bit about wisdom, but I'd like to talk about more practical things too later as well, because that can help us when we're dealing with fear and anxiety. Of course, wisdom, as I said, gives us the bigger picture, but as you saw from that story too, it also enables us, this is the function of wisdom, to let go. When we understand something, we can let go. We can accept things as they are at the moment, but realizing we can change in the future. And so one of the things that I thought of, and I think probably many people have thought of this, is there are two types of coronavirus. And one is of the body and one is of the mind, isn't it? You can see that the physical aspects of the sickness and in some cases death is one aspect, but what the virus has done in terms of people's minds is this fear and this panic, this anxiety. And it reminded me of the Buddha's teaching to one of his very old, who was a very old disciple, Nakulapitta, in the Connected Discourses, where he says to Nakulapitta, who says, I'd like to come and see you, Blessed One, more often, but I am now very old, 80 or more than 80, and my body doesn't allow me to come as much as I would like. And the Buddha said to him, even though your body be sick, do not let your mind be sick. When he said this, this was sort of like a training for Nakulapitta to remember what's important, the body. Even though the body is sick, to look after the mind. And this is so important, I think, at this time. And that's I thought we could rephrase that as, so whether one has coronavirus or not, may one's mind not be sick with fear, anxiety and depression. And it's very, one of the aspects of the Buddha's teachings that's very important. He said there are two darts that every human being, every being really, is hit by. These darts are like arrows, I don't know another word that would be better for that. And he said that that is the body and the mind. And this is what we're talking about with Nākalapitta. So the whole of the Buddha's teaching is about removing the mental dart, the dart of the mind, the difficulties, the negative states of mind, removing these and reducing our difficulties, our suffering, and eventually eliminating it. In terms of the body, the Buddha had a body, and he had aches and pains, sicknesses like everyone else. And of course, all bodies are of the same nature. They have to pass away. They do pass away, and they all end up in the same place. But it's very important to think what we're doing with the mind, because not only does that, you know, the quality of our mind determines the quality of our experience, doesn't it? If we have a mind that's full of loving kindness, being the best, our own best friend, the world is going to appear like this. This is the lens, the filter that we'll see the world through. Or we can, and many people do, develop the fear, the anxiety, the panic or depression, and see the world through that. And more importantly, is not only is this important in our daily life, how we're experiencing life here and now, but in terms of the Buddhist teaching, we take our minds with us. It's not the same, it's not a permanent mind. Can't say that. It's not a permanent mind. But the qualities we've developed, good or bad, we take with us. And I liken this to, you know, when we go on a trip, when we go to a travel, which we can't do now, we can't travel because of the coronavirus, do we open our suitcase and empty the rubbish bin in there and take it with us on our travels? Or do we open the suitcase and put all the good things, all the things that we need for our travels when we arrive wherever we're going? And of course, we want to take the good things, the things we need when we arrive wherever we're going. Not the rubbish. But unless we are working on the mind, improving, developing the qualities of the mind, we will be taking those negative aspects with us into the next life. So it's very important for us here and now to do this work. Not only do we get the benefits here and now, but we'll get the benefits in the future. So when we arrive at whatever next life we have, whatever rebirth we have, we'll open the suitcase and it will be good things, not the rubbish that we had from the previous life. So this is the aim. Of course, the aim of the Buddha's teaching, of course, is to go beyond being reborn, to free the mind totally. And this is the bigger picture. And we do that by, firstly, purifying the mind of these negative qualities like fear, like anxiety, and developing wisdom. So these are very important aspects of developing the mind, so that we take with us those qualities that will be useful for us. Or we finish with rebirth, if that is possible. And recently someone sent me a quotation that I thought was very good for, you know, when you think of the coronavirus now. And, you know, I'm sure many people, you could substitute what I'm going to say for coronavirus. And it was a quote from Ajahn Sumedho. I think many people would have heard of Ajahn Sumedho. He's an American monk who lived in Britain a long time and is now living in Thailand. And he's probably the most senior student of Ajahn Chah, the famous meditation master from northeast Thailand. And Ajahn Sumedho evidently had malaria for 1 year. I thought, goodness me, that must have been incredibly difficult. I don't know whether it was every night having fevers, but very regularly. And then Ajahn Chah came to visit him, and he was complaining to Ajahn Chah that he couldn't practice anymore, he said. His practice was gone out the window. It was ruined by this malaria. And then Ajahn Rukchar replied to him, "Ah," he said, "now your practice is malaria." So that's true for all of us. I mean, whatever we're experiencing, that is our practice. You know, and our practice is to deal with it in a skillful way, the best possible way we can. And if we are developing positive states of mind in our practice with these difficult things, malaria, coronavirus, the fear of coronavirus, this is developing the mind. This is part of our practice. Sometimes we may think the practice is walking meditation, sitting meditation, and they are important parts of the practice because we can recondition the mind by doing these practices, develop more of being in the present moment. We can develop more loving kindness, which we can take into daily life. But it is for a reconditioning for us to take into daily life. But the whole purpose of the path is to develop the wholesome, develop the positive, let go of the unwholesome, the negative, to develop those and to develop the roots of the positive so that we can go beyond, eventually go beyond birth and free the mind. So when we have this view of practice, it means that we look at our lives, we look at our experience in a different way. We don't look at it in such personal terms. And it reminded me of the famous story of Kisa Gotami. I think many, many people probably know the story of Kisa Gotami, probably saying, "Oh no, isn't it? Not that story again." And of course, I call it Kisa Gotami wisdom, but it's the wisdom that we can all develop from our own experience of life, our own practice, which is what we're experiencing. And this is, Kisa Gotami had a son, a child, and the son had died, but she was in denial, utter denial. She thought the child was just sick. I think this is quite interesting, because if it wasn't breathing, this is quite an amazing amount of denial. And so she went to all the people in her village, in the area, and went to all the doctors, to all those that were gifted in healing, to ask for healing for her child, to bring him back to life. And all of them couldn't help her. And I don't know if any of them told her, "Look, the baby's dead." Even if they had, I'm sure she wouldn't have believed it. So eventually, maybe out of exasperation, they said, "Why don't you go and visit the Buddha?" Probably just to get rid of Kisa Gotami. And she went to visit the Buddha, and she asked the Buddha, "Can you help me with my son? You know, he's just sick." And the Buddha said, yes, I can help you." And she was overjoyed. At last, someone who was being positive. And she was, but he said, "You need to go to a house in the village and get 2 or 3 mustard seeds." And she thought, fantastic, this is easy. They all use mustard seeds for making mustard seed oil and cooking and that sort of thing. And she was off to get her 2 or 3 seeds of mustard seeds. And then the Buddha said, "But it must be from a house where no one has died." And so she went to house after house. Uncle had died, auntie had died, mother had died, one of the children had died. And I don't know how long it took her, but eventually she realized, my son has died. And she could accept it. She realized, this is not just my own personal tragedy, my own sadness. I'm not the only person that's experienced this. And then she could go to the Buddha and bow down to him, put the baby down. And the Buddha gave her a teaching on impermanence, the fact that all things are of this nature, to change, to be impermanent, nothing lasts. And then she, I think at that time, became the first stage of enlightenment, stream entry, and was able to bury the baby and become a nun and become fully enlightened. So this is amazing. But this is using her own experience, our own experience, whatever it is, you know, we start from where we're at. Yeah. So this is very important that we use that to grow our own wisdom and see that this wisdom applies to everyone. And so it's not, wisdom is not something that's very remote. It's not something that's, well, it is in the books to a certain extent, but the point with wisdom in the Buddha's teaching is it's got to be our own. The Buddha's wisdom is borrowed wisdom, isn't it? We're borrowing it, but it's very useful until we can grow our own, until it becomes our own direct experience, because that is what the Buddha's teachings aim at. To grow our own wisdom. And one of the most important things for doing that is realizing where things are coming from, where this fear, where this anxiety, this panic is coming from. And the Buddha talks about it in one of his teachings in the middle length discourses, the Sambhasva Sutta. Where he says that when we pay attention to something, it's giving rise to a negative state of mind. This is not something for our benefit, our well-being. So if we give attention to things and it's giving rise to fear, anxiety, or anger, jealousy, whatever that emotion be, and we know this is something we shouldn't necessarily pay attention to if we can avoid it. And conversely, this is called ayoniso manasikara. And conversely, those things that give rise to positive states of mind, wholesome states of mind, when we pay attention to them, these are things that we can encourage. So at this time, of course, you know, it's a bit of a mixed bag when you think of some of the things we pay attention to, like the news, for instance, which can feed for many people, you know, this feeling of fear and anxiety. Because I don't know whether you noticed, nearly all of it's coronavirus, pretty much, I think. And for some people, just seeing that news over and over again will give rise to, will rekindle, bring up even more these negative emotions. So we have to decide for ourselves, you know, what is benefiting us. What, when we pay attention to it, is it giving rise to positive states of mind or negative states of mind? And also, one of the things that comes with that is to be aware of the thinking that is giving rise to negative states of mind. What is the thinking that is behind, feeding, fueling this sense of fear, panic, anxiety? Just to see what the thinking is. Because once we recognize the thinking, quite often that's enough actually, but we can see what is fueling it, because these feelings, all the feelings that we have, are coming from thoughts that are feeding them. So when we actually recognize them, that can be an antidote in itself. We can distance ourselves. We're looking at it rather than being it. This is the point of it. We see it rather than be it. That's what I usually say. See it rather than be it. But also, it means if we can understand what thought is fueling it, we can come up with alternative, what I call mantras, for the situation. And one of my favourites, you know, especially for fear and anxiety, is the mantra I use sometimes. Everything will be all right. Everything will be all right. And there's a story that goes with that, because when I was in Sri Lanka and was coming to Australia, I was Also, coming to, because of a health problem, coming to Australia, so that was on my mind. But I was leaving the village. I lived in a cave for 8 years, a very comfy cave, I should say. And I was got on the bus in this village in Sri Lanka. It's in the back of beyond. And they never have any English songs. They never have any English songs. Always in Sinhala or Hindi. And they're usually love songs, all about love. Same as the West, actually. And this day, I got on the bus. And then the song that they played was Bob Marley. And the song is Everything Will Be All Right. I couldn't believe it. I thought, my goodness. It was just extraordinary. But I thought, when I heard that, I thought, am I worried? But it occurred to me, this is a very good mantra too for us at these times of uncertainty. There are many others we can use as well, but whatever works for oneself. But so this recognizing what's fueling the negative thoughts and then finding a mantra that works with them. So one of the, that's a very important part of it too, but also to realize in terms of, I must move on I think, in terms of wisdom where fear and anxiety, panic come from. And I think probably the best source, the most obvious source of that, and this is the feeling side of it, is insecurity is what's feeding it. The insecurity, the uncertainty, the instability we experience in life because of impermanence. This is one of the central aspects of the Buddha's teaching, is impermanence. This is why existence is as it is. It's because everything is impermanent, changes, subject to change without any notice. And we're experiencing that now. We experience it in life in terms of old age, sickness, and of course death. So it's this insecurity coming from this, what I call the fabric of samsara, is this impermanence. And it reminds me of a lovely story Ajahn Chah told when he was, before he was a monk actually, he was with a group of friends and they were looking at some beautiful ruins in Thailand. I think they were some Khmer ruins, so they were people from Cambodia. And they were looking at this beautiful temple that had this huge cracks in it and broken down, and his friends were saying to him, oh, isn't it terrible, isn't it awful that in such a beautiful building has, you know, got all these cracks in it and is a ruin now. And Ajahn Chah, he wasn't Ajahn Chah then, he was a layman, he said, he even felt like that too, but he said, he had to bring Dhamma into it, he said, if those buildings weren't cracked, there'd be no need for a Buddha, because there would be no impermanence, there would be no change, this unreliability, this instability that gives rise to our insecurity, which gives rise to our fears. And the other aspect, that's the central root of fear and anxiety, is just this inability to control existence. Existence is as it is. Our response to insecurity, fear, anxiety is more and more control. We try it. But the other aspect of that, of course, is the thing that is driving most of our fears and anxiety is sickness and death. Those two. These are very principal. These are aspects the Buddha says we should contemplate frequently. He said old age, sickness, death, and also the fact that we will be parted from all that is dear and delightful, that will be, can become otherwise. In other words, it can change from being dear and delightful. So these are aspects that the Buddha said we need to contemplate frequently. Often. And he said not only for monks and nuns, you might think, well, that's fine for the monks and nuns, But he said for the laymen and the laywomen as well. Because when we come to terms with these things, when we see this impermanence, when we understand the bigger picture and see it in terms of the bigger picture, then we don't take it so personally. Then there is not so much fear and worry because of it. These experiences, then we know that where we have to put our investment in life, where we have to put most of the work, most of the effort into the mind, into developing the mind. So many people like to develop the body, and they have maybe beautiful bodies, very strong bodies, all this sort of thing, very picturesque bodies. Bodies that can appear very nice on Facebook and these other social media. But what about the mind? This is actually the more important thing. And I really like when I see these photographs of these beautiful movie stars when they were young, handsome, beautiful. And then I see them when they're 60, 70, 80. It's just such a, you know, you just see it all. And it reminds you, where is the important place? Most important place to put our attention on the mind. This is what we live with. This is our home. And as I said, the mind travels on, so we wanted to take with it all the good things. So the point of contemplating impermanence is to have that shock absorber, which expects the unexpected, can absorb that, can not be swept away by it. And that's a nice simile that Ajahn Chah also had used, which is the simile of a dam. He said a dam, if it doesn't have a spillway, this is where the excess water, you know, when there's a lot of rain, runs off. If it doesn't have a spillway, the water goes over the dam, destroys the dam, and probably many homes, buildings, people's lives below. But if it has the spillway, no problems, it's quite safe, and that dam will remain. In the same way, if we understand, if we have a understanding of impermanence, the deeper we understand it, the better. We have the spillway, so that when we lose our job, when we find out we have cancer, when we know someone very close who's got coronavirus, we can absorb that, we can take that, not be swept away by it. So this is a very, very important part of what wisdom can do for us, actually. Give us that bigger perspective, that bigger picture. And I was going to mention too, because one of the interesting ways that the Buddha practiced before he became the Buddha, actually, it's in the Fear and Dread Sutta in the Middle Length Discourses. I think it's number 4. And the Buddha-to-be, he would go to these scary places. He talks about these very scary places. And he would notice that he'd hear a sound. And then this fear and dread would come on him. Oh, it's a tiger coming for me, a lion coming for me. It's India. A lion coming for me or a tiger coming for me. And he said, when that fear and dread came, I would not change my posture. So if I was walking, I'd continue walking until the fear and dread had gone, passed away. And he said, the same for each of the postures. If the fear and dread came while he was lying down, while he was standing, while he was sitting, he would keep those postures until it had passed away. In that way, he really confronted fear and anxiety, this fear and dread, as he called it. That takes quite a bit of strength, but we can do it if we use that example of the Buddha. So now I'd just like to briefly talk about compassion. I haven't got to that at all. So compassion is a very important aspect of our practice. And I hope that this meditation that I did being one's own best friend and being the best friend of others is a good example of how we can cultivate positive emotions. Ayakema, one of my teachers, she was a Buddhist nun, passed away in 1997, she called these the four Brahmaviharas, we call them. She used to call them the four supreme emotions. It's quite lovely, I like that. Four supreme emotions. And she said that they're only worthwhile emotions to develop. And this is, of course, loving kindness, compassion, joy with others' successes or good qualities. I'll be teaching that tomorrow. And equanimity. These are the qualities. We can develop these wholesome states of mind. When we do, you know, then this fear, anxiety goes down. It gives less opportunity for these negative emotions to develop, to grow. And it gives rise to a very pleasant experience here and now. But very practical way that people can bring up happiness in their life at this time is any form of giving we can perform, whether it's online, whether it's in person, you know, just small acts of kindness, these things. It doesn't have to be physical things. It can just be listening to people, being there for them, sharing something online. So this is a very good way to bring up happy states of mind and joyful states of mind as well. And of course, you know, this is very important, is another way of developing this joy and happiness is reflecting on the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. That those recollections can bring up, the Buddha said, they can bring up gladness. Once we get the inspiration from the meaning, we can develop gladness, he said. We can develop joy. We can develop this tranquility, this peace in the body and mind, and then happiness, and then the samadhi, the mind coming together, or stillness, as Ajahn Brahm calls it. So these are very important ways to bring up this inner happiness, this inner joy, which will decrease any of the negative states of mind. And I mentioned too before mindfulness, developing more and more mindfulness, even if we just do a few minutes a day. This coming into the present moment and letting go of the past and the future cuts the roots of a lot of the problems of fear and anxiety or depression. So this is another very, very important way that we can give the mind an oasis of safety, is what I call it, oasis of safety, this friendliness and this kindness to ourselves and to others. And as I mentioned, when we do this, we're creating this sort of sense of connection. We do not feel so isolated. We do not feel so far away. I don't anyway, I find. But also in terms of compassion, it's very good at this time. I think most people, hopefully many people are doing it anyway, is look after the body by exercising, doing exercises, looking after however those exercises are possible. And also one of the big antidotes physically, I had an email from somebody who sent me some advice that Venerable Yoga Vachara Rahula, the American monk, he's a yoga teacher too, was giving in response, he's a Buddhist monk, giving in response to the coronavirus. And he was saying, do some deep breathing and just breathe in deeply, hold for 2 or 3 seconds and then breathe out. Just do a few of those. It's extraordinary. It's very, very helpful. Ajahn Chah recommended this for when we have a lot of thinking happening, but it's very good for when we have a lot of fear or anxiety going. So I'd recommend that too, myself. I'd recommend that. And there's a nice technique that's very much aimed at anxiety in particular and fear, and that is one called the 4-7-8 breath. And there's a nice video on YouTube. I've got it here, but there's no screen. Asleep in 60 Seconds, it's called. And it's Dr. Andrew Wilde, so that's very good. So we have the physical, we have the meditation, as I mentioned before, but very useful thing in the meditation too is to, we can use very peaceful images. This can calm the mind too. For instance, a Buddha statue is lovely, very peaceful, serene Buddha statue with a slight smile. Can really calm one down. And I'm amazed when I, in Melbourne, where I've been staying recently, you walk around and you see Buddha statues in gardens left, right and centre. And the main reason, I suspect, is that people find it very peaceful, very grounding. So this sort of thing is very, very useful if we have things that bring up peaceful states of mind, whether it be a Buddha statue, whether it be scenes of beaches, forests, rivers, mountains, lakes, very beautiful, can be very useful. And also walking in nature is a very useful thing when we're feeling anxious or fearful. Just having a walk in a park can be very, very useful. And so there are some things that can help. And here I've got some extra mantras too. Besides, everything will be all right. You're okay. Never mind. No matter. That's what I... But one of the most important things of being our own best friend is that we can soothe ourselves too, like a child, like a parent would a child. And that's another image the Buddha uses for loving kindness. A parent or a mother's love for her only child. So I'd like to finish there. I think that's getting close to the time. And to encourage all of us, myself included, to develop these positive states of mind and let go of negative states of mind, of fear, anxiety. This is part of right effort. This is part of the Noble Eightfold Path. It's the sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path is avoiding the negative, letting go of it, developing the positive, maintaining it. But if we develop the positive, if we maintain the positive, there's not much space for the negative. So I wish you all well in developing a mind that is at home with itself, a mind that is its own best friend. So then we can be comfortable when we have to spend more and more, if we have to spend more time with ourselves. Then our homes are places of retreat and not places that feel like prisons. So I wish everyone well at this time, difficult time, but it's a part of our practice too. So thank you very much for watching this, and I hope it's been of use to you, and that we can grow and develop from these difficult times. So sad. I think there's some questions now. All right. Oh, all right, that's great. All right. So this is Lucy from France. How can we be a best friend to those who are enemies to us? Exactly. Well, the most important thing I find with people that... Well, there are two sides to it, aren't there? Do we regard them as enemies or do they regard us as enemies? We don't have to regard them as enemies. But if people are difficult to be with, if they cause upset and we have a negative response, we get angry, if we want to say things, do things, then I always say the person that needs the loving kindness is ourselves. If we have it, then we'll deal with that person in the best possible way, in a better way. So it's not possible that the whole world will be that we'll be on good terms with everyone, but we can still have loving kindness for all beings. But the best One of the important things with loving kindness is not to personalize it too much. You might have noticed, even though we started from ourselves, we didn't go into particular people. You know, some techniques of loving kindness, you look at those that are near and dear, those that are neutral, and those that are enemies. It is best not to specify too much, because if you do, you get caught up with the stories connected with them, and then the loving kindness becomes derailed. So what we can do with those who are enemies is just include them in all beings, but not focus on them. Because, as I mentioned with Ayoniso Manasikara, if we pay attention to them and negative qualities are developing, what good is that for us? These are just triggers for us. And we don't want to encourage these states that are in ourselves. That's the important thing to realize, that people out there, situations out there, are all triggers for the emotions we experience. They can be negative triggers and give rise to the negative emotions that are inside ourselves, the fear, the anxiety, the anger, the depression, inside us. But as Ayakema used to say, and I think it's a fantastic saying, don't blame the trigger. That's what she said, don't blame the trigger. But I say, look for the positive triggers. So that's what I'd encourage. So I hope that was of use. And thank you. Oh, look, this handwritten. Very good. DY from USA. That's it. Good. Do you think people are in denial because of their strong belief systems and conditioning from childhood? How can they open their minds? Right. Do you think people are because of their strong belief systems and conditioning from childhood? I'm not sure what sort of denial you're thinking of. Yeah, denial of reality, yes, for sure. People and one's, yes, strong belief systems definitely can lead to us not being open to as things as they are. And this is the important thing with meditation, that it is clearing away those hindrances, those negative states of mind, that prepare the mind for wisdom. They prepare the mind, they make them, bring the mind to purity. They let go of the negative qualities, the hindrances. So then we can see things as they truly are. But many people, as you say, they're clinging on to strong belief systems and conditioning from childhood. Some of that is out of fear and anxiety. That this is a reaction to a world where impermanence is the main feature, the main experience, where we want to deny it because of by finding security in a strong belief, whatever that belief may be, and also taking refuge in conditioning, as you say. How can they open their mind? They can only open their minds when the conditions are right, when they meet something. Usually, what opens our minds in life? Difficulties, problems. That's what, challenges. That's what opens our minds. Those challenges bring up, require us to look at life in a different way. And so that's what will happen. And this is what happens, doesn't it? When somebody, for instance, you know, their relationship, the love of their life, leaves them. Wow, that's going to require a big mind shift that will cause a lot of difficulty, a lot of suffering for that person. But then they will start to, they don't necessarily do this, they can start to look more deeply. Often people take refuge in a distraction, in taking alcohol and drugs, whatever it is, but it can be any of our difficult experiences in life, whether it be, as I say, a relationship breakup, whether it be a very serious illness or approaching death, can really open our minds to reality. And the reality, of course, is always impermanence, unsatisfactoriness. And we say non-self. the essence of life, because things are impermanent, changeable, not possible to get permanent happiness, not possible to get perfection amidst all this imperfection, not possible to get a permanent self. And this is why, you know, anicca, why impermanence is what I call the flaw in existence, FLAW. It's the flaw in existence that makes life the way it is. So, as I say, people, once they experience some difficulty in their life, then that is a possibility for opening their minds, or even clinging more strongly to a strong belief system or some conditioning. So that's for DY in the USA. And question two from Sarah in WA. Why does the thought of being a best friend to the self sometimes feel painful? Oh, that's interesting. I think the reason it can feel painful is perhaps because one isn't a best friend to oneself. You know, one can't accept oneself as one is. One hasn't got that kindness for oneself. So if there is pain, if one experiences pain, I suspect that it's coming from that fact that experience that it's not easy for us to be our own best friend. And it's so important that we're on good terms with ourselves, that we are at home with ourselves, because then we will be our own best friend. So that's, yes, sometimes feels pain. So I hope that yes, I think some people, when they think of being their own best friend, then it may make them sad in the sense that they realise this is something missing in their life. It's been missing, and that they're not their own best friend, and that so often what we're listening to, the voices in our heads, are those negative voices that say, you're not good enough, you could be better than this, you know, you don't look good enough, you're not smart enough, you're all those things. And we listen to that. And of course, you know, this is not going to lead to happiness. It's not going to lead to growth. It's not going to lead to accepting ourselves, being kind to ourselves. And when we are able to do that, when we are able to be our own best friend, we can maximize our own potential. We will be relaxed. We can come from a really, truly creative place, kind place. So that's what I would say. I don't know if that answers what you had in mind, Sarah from WA. So thank you very much. And now it's just after 9 o'clock, so I'd like to finish by paying respects to the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha.
Sankhang namami.